you're going to see a lot more actions where we really try to bring the war machine to a halt. And it's going to be creative, and it's going to be unexpected.
When you go to a press conference, whether it's here in Doha, at the White House, or at the Pentagon, you realize the official doing the speaking is really not speaking to the reporters in that room.
Unless we have a regime change in Washington, I can see nothing but sort of instability and chaos spreading across the world for the near future.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, April 7th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Police crack down on anti-war protesters from New York to Oakland. U.S. tanks rumble through downtown Baghdad, seizing one of Saddam Hussein's palaces. And President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair plan for discussions over the so-called spoils of war. Those stories and more on tonight's Peace Watch, but first, these news headlines.
With headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonicky Lafice.
And I'm Daniel Costello. President Bush flew into Belfast today for a war summit with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. This is the third British-American summit meeting, and this time the focus is on settling differences about post-war Iraq. China and Japan want the United Nations to play a role in Iraq's post-war reconstruction. Japan has backed the war, while China has vehemently opposed it. But both agreed today at a meeting in Beijing that the UN must be involved in the rebuilding process in Iraq.
Independent reporter Urban Hamid reports today from Baghdad that he observed cluster bombs being used by the United States forces.
I went to a settlement outside Baghdad called Baladiyat 2 days ago, and I basically saw cluster bombs that had not exploded that were still there. I saw the effects of cluster bombs, and according to people I spoke with there, many civilians had sustained injuries from cluster bombs from that particular bombing.
A jury today in a federal district court in Colorado found three nuns guilty of sabotage and depredation of federal property. The nuns hammered on the cement cover of a missile silo and drew crosses with their blood. One of the attorneys for the nuns, Sue Taberski, says they will make motions to overturn the decision.
The office of multinational peacekeeping force in northern Aceh, Indonesia, was burned by pro-military masses yesterday. Maggie Margiano reports from Jakarta.
Mobs burned the office of the Joint Security Committee in Eastern Aceh on Sunday, while another office of the committee was burned a week before. Last week, a series of organized violence happened at Aceh, one of Indonesia's provinces where the armed independent movement has been growing for the last 3 decades. Human rights activists were kidnapped by the intelligence officials and the bomb blasted in Aceh border city Medan. Responding to the recent burning, Indonesia Military Commander General Endriartono Sutarto said it was caused by the misinterpretation of the Joint Security Council role in Aceh. 2 months before, Sutarto warned the committee he did not intend to enforce law in Indonesia. The series of violence has resulted in a military representation in the committee. Indonesia prominent human rights activist Munir Mak military maneuver in Aceh is nothing different with their maneuver in East Timor during months of fascist massive killing in 1999. Maggie Margiono, Indymedia Jakarta, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Confusion still surrounds the massacre of up to 1,000 people in the town of Drodro in the Democratic Republic of Congo last Thursday, just hours after the Congo's government and various group leaders signed a deal on a transition government. Amo Boadi reports.
The 1,000 victims of the massacre in the Democratic Republic of Congo on Thursday came from the Hema ethnic group, which has been in conflict with the Lendus in a land-based conflict that has intensified during the civil war, which started in 1998 and has led to the deaths of at least 50,000 people to date. Uganda, which has maintained troops in the Congo since the start of the civil war, has rejected accusations by various rebel leaders that it played any part in the massacre and has sent up to 800 extra troops to the nearby town of Bunia for, quote, the protection of the people.
Dina Montague, an independent journalist who has just returned from the Congo, talks about the roots of this conflict.
These ethnic conflicts are being fueled because there are so many mineral resources which are ending up in Uganda and Rwanda and exported to countries in the West. Unless there is a major effort put forth by the UN to increase the number of peacekeepers that are on the ground, these kind of massacres are going to continue.
For FSRN, I am Amabwadi.
It's the peak of the cherry blossom season in Tokyo, but instead of enjoying a hanami, Japanese for a cherry blossom party, Miles Ashdown reports that thousands took to the streets to collectively say one thing.
The U.S.-led attack on Iraq has sparked a lot of people in Japan to protest. In fact, the demonstrations are the largest since those against the Vietnam War. Paul Mason, an activist here in Tokyo, says the war created a groundswell of activism here and around the world.
There are people that have never participated in demonstrations before, and they're out on the streets really voicing their opinion in ways that are far stronger than anything that they might have done before. So I think the movement is growing. The power is with us, and I believe that we can change the world for the better.
Mr. Mason said people today are more aware and better prepared to make a better world. In Tokyo, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miles Ashdown.
From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonaki Lafis.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. military is testing samples from a site in Iraq where soldiers found metal drums containing possible chemical weapons, according to defense officials. But officials say tests at laboratories in the U.S. have to be completed before the presence of chemical weapons could be determined. Soldiers from the Army's 101st Airborne Division reportedly found the material in a compound near the Iraqi city of Hendaya, about 60 miles south of Baghdad. Video of the search taken by CNN showed soldiers in gas mask using handheld chemical weapons detectors to investigate the metal drums. General Benjamin Freakley told CNN this could be either some type of pesticide because this was an agricultural compound. On the other hand, it could be a chemical agent, not weaponized. Dozens of U.S. tanks rumbled through downtown Baghdad today, seizing one of Saddam Hussein's palaces and toppling a 40-foot statue of the Iraqi leader. Some Iraqi soldiers reportedly jumped into the Tigris River to flee the advancing tanks. Others were captured and placed inside a hastily erected POW pen on the grounds of the blue and gold domed new presidential palace. Hundreds of journalists from around the world are in the region reporting on the U.S. and British invasion of Iraq, and among them is George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspapers Publishers Association, a news service. He's just arrived in Qatar, the headquarters for the U.S. military's central command post, about 700 miles south of Baghdad. We spoke with Curry this morning about the challenges for journalists in the region attempting to cover the war under the watchful eye of the military.
Well, when you go on a base as a journalist, you go in. Of course, you have to get through the original checkpoint. When you come up to the door, they have dogs sniff all your bags. Then you walk inside the door, bags are checked by hand. And then you go to a big scanning machine that scans you from the front, and you turn around, they scan you in the back. And at that point, you can pick up your press badge. Then you're escorted to a bus, and then you go to the press center. And that's the procedure every day. So you have to go through all that. Of course, they take all the precautions they can. What you sense is that there's a very different attitude in terms of how this war is covered abroad versus how it's covered at home. At home, we have journalists who are unashamedly walking around with American flags on their lapel, and they're supposed to be objective. Here, you get very different critical coverage. The BBC coverage, for example, is always extremely sharp. You even have the Iraqi television station here asking questions every day in briefing. And a lot of discussion really has turned to what's going to be like, Iraq is going to be like after the war.
Mm. So the discussion has already advanced to the aftermath. Let me ask
it
you.
It has, because they've already talked about, you know, being within 10 miles of the city and actually making forays into the city of Baghdad. And so a lot of questions about what happens after. Is we going to have a United States East station there? We won't have. On United Nations as a larger role, or you're going to get the people who are native Iraqis, now that they're airlifted some of them back, are they going to be in charge, and who makes that decision?
Mm. George, how many journalists are actually traveling with the military in the so-called embedded status, and how many independent journalists are there covering this war?
I think there are about 600, 600 or 700 embedded. And the disadvantage there is you get just one slice of it. You really don't get an overall view of it. If you hear it at CENTCOM, you get one piece, and that's pretty much the official view. And you really, you know, the best you can do is have a lot of them embedded, and then you have people covered here as well. And that's not ideal, but that's about the best you can do. Of course, you know, At least a half dozen journalists have been killed, including three Americans, two the last week. So it's dangerous even when you're with the embedded troops.
Mm. Well, I'm having a little trouble figuring out how the journalists are able to provide independent accounts of what's taking place if the Pentagon is the only version of facts they're receiving, and those traveling in bed, we like to say, with the military, yes, of course, have their reports monitored and scrutinized by the Pentagon and are subject to being ejected from the battlefield if their reports don't measure up to the military muster.
I don't think it's quite that bad. I think you are limited because by virtue of where you are and you're reliant on the soldiers around you to protect your life. So, I mean, that's not an ideal situation, but covering war is not ideal. The option, it seems to me, is this. Either you accept those kind of compromises in terms of being embedded, not necessarily letting anybody sense of what you're right, but being embedded in restrictions that go with that, either you accept that and see a slice of the war, or you do like we did before and don't see any of it. I mean, so that's the option. It's not ideal, no question about it. But I think that because we have so many reporters embedded in different places, sometimes we're seeing this now, you're getting reports coming back that do conflict with the official version.
George, the International Committee of the Red Cross says civilian casualties are at a point now where they're actually too high for them to keep an accurate account. What is the Pentagon saying about the high numbers of civilian casualties, given the assurances that the Bush administration gave the American people prior to the war that every attempt would be made to avoid these civilian casualties and the supposed advanced technology that the U.S. is using, i.e. the smart bombs?
Right.
Is there any mention at all of these briefings about the casualties of civilians?
Well, we talked about that today in Doha. Asked him about that today, what General Brooks did is what he always does. He refused to give you any numbers, saying he can't confirm it. He says that there have been civilian targets, they're never civilian targets, but sometimes they get hit. And he actually accused Iraq of putting civilians in their way. I mean, that's these things we heard from the first Persian Gulf War. So, I mean, not being that you really, really can't say, but they're refusing to say how many, and they're saying that, you're going to have some in a war, but they've done everything they could to limit it. That's their line.
And so do the journalists seem to be pressing that issue at all?
You can press it all you want. If you've got a good briefer, they're going to tell you what they want to know. I mean, let's be honest. They are not really talking to the journalists in that room. When you go to a press conference, whether it's here in Doha or whether it's at the White House or whether it's at the Pentagon, and now I've been to all three places, you realize the person doing the speaking, the official doing the speaking, is really not speaking to the reporters in that room. They happen to be a conduit. They're really speaking to a larger American audience and a larger international audience. So, yeah, you're going to try to solicit information. You're going to ask the toughest question you can. But if you have a skilled briefer, and General Brooks is certainly that, they're going to divulge only so much information.
What are your plans for covering this war? How do you intend to? What story ideas do you have?
Right now, I plan to be here for a while. I'm not sure at what point, if any, that I'll move north, but I certainly hope to go to Baghdad. It's amazing to me how there's such a strong African-American force among the leadership here, beyond General Brooks and key position around here. There are two black colonels right under him. There's a sergeant major for the command is African-American. There's a woman who meets you at the door. Everywhere from the top general to the person who holds the microphone for the reporters asking a question, the command structure here is fully integrated. But you look at the media, I'm the only black reporter there among several hundred reporters.
And how would you characterize the racial composition of the troops there on the front line?
We know that they're always disproportionate to our population. I mean, that's what we serve in the military. You have that.
And so what is the official military version of events at this particular time that they were trying to put forward this morning at the briefing?
Well, they say every day that they are making the progress they wanted to make, and they retain, I think it was two oil refinery fires going. They said they've extinguished one of them. They're advancing on the city of Baghdad, and they're confident they're going to be victorious. I mean, that's what they say. They stand by it every day. A lot of discussions already been pointed forward in terms of what happens in a post-war Iraq.
George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspapers Publishers Association, a news service, speaking with us from Doha, Qatar.
In the news leaves me amazed. So much to choose from in disinfo age. Satellite sky,
every square inch, clean, cut and dried, but it leaves me unquenched. A villain appears, his role has been cast, our duty is clear, so unlike our past. The bombers take aim and they light up the screen, a video game or a war that we're seeing.
Tragic Magic by Dialectics. Though the U.S. military's entrance into Baghdad is still in its initial stages, the question of who will lead Iraq after Saddam Hussein is gone and the issue of post-war reconstruction is very much on everyone's minds. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Ian Williams, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine, about the prospects for Iraq's future government and the Bush administration's choice for a former arms dealer to lead the country.
Well, there are lots of reports from different places about the post-war administration, and it depends on who you're talking to. I think the situation is really fluid. Certainly they're going to need Iraqis, because I think we can guarantee that none of the Americans brought in, with one or two exceptions, will be able to speak any Arabic. So they're going to need someone to be able to talk to the locals. But today, Kofi Annan at the United Nations announced the sort of formal appointment of Rafauddin Ahmed, who is a Pakistani who used to be high in the UN Development Programme, as his special advisor, which means that, in a sense, it looks like Kofi Annan is setting him up as the UN's counterpart to Jay Garner, who, as you know, is the would-be American viceroy-in-waiting.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ian, you recently wrote an article on the alternet.org website about General Jay Garner, who you call the man who would be king of Iraq. Can you talk a bit about who Garner is, what his background is, and why he's being sort of chosen or handpicked by the Bush administration to lead Iraq?
Well, he's sort of favorite chum of Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and the others, and his history is not inspiring. I think it would take an administration like this to put in an avowed pro-Israeli, general in charge of Iraq. Because one thing that Iraqis of all sort of complexions agree on is they do not like Ariel Sharon. But General Garner actually went to Israel in year 2000, and with a lot of other American military, signed a declaration marveling at the moderation of the Israeli army's response to the Intifada. If that's the way he's going to run Iraq, it's going to be very dangerous.
You found in your research that Garner's civilian career has close ties also to the defense contractor SY Technology. Do you see that as a conflict of interest?
Well, it sort of clearly is, especially with the contracts floating around at the moment. It seems a little, let's say, it's not in the great traditions of politeness to appoint somebody to govern a place that's been making his money by selling weapons to drop on it first. And there's also a sort of revolving door aspect. General Garner was the general in charge of the Patriot missiles in the first Gulf War, which he declared were 100% successful, and carried on saying so, even when it was subsequently revealed that they missed all of their targets and actually caused more damage than the incoming Scuds. He then went on to be head of the Star Wars, the whole sort of Star Wars strategic defense initiative. And that's interesting, because that's one of the, he's actually combined some of the big theological imperatives of this administration, which is a belief in Star Wars and a belief that whatever Israel does is right. Neither of these particularly equip him to deal with Iraq, I would suspect.
What kind of reaction has there been from the Iraqis in exile? Have you been following their reaction to, say, General Jay Garner? Is this someone that they would support?
It's a mixture. Of course, some of them who have no domestic constituency at all will support him, because he's their only hope of getting parachuted into power. But some of the Iraqi National Congress do represent genuine forces within the country, and they are not happy at the idea of having a foreign viceroy suddenly put over them. And then we have the whole sort of the rest of the world, like Kofi Annan and Tony Blair, who thinks that the United Nations should have some role in legitimating any post-war rule. As you know, today Blair and Bush are there, and it's going to be yet another sort of ships passing in the night, I suspect, as they talk past each other without quite, Bush can't quite understand what his chum's on about, even though he might like to help him. but he's not going to cross Rumsfeld and Cheney to do so.
Prime Minister Blair is presenting some sort of official proposal that the UN have an ongoing role in post-Saddam Iraq?
Yes, he's been pushing for this a long time, and you know, he's actually making himself sort of quite popular, I think, with the Europeans and the others who had disagreed with him hitherto, because he's been quite dogged about it. He knows that the future stability of Iraq and the sort of the retrospective credibility of this operation depends upon a United Nations presence, a genuine international presence as represented by the United Nations. And, of course, the other stumbling block he's pushing on is the roadmap to Middle East peace, where even as Bush goes to Northern Ireland to meet Tony Blair, I understand Israeli government officials are coming to Washington to tell them that they find the roadmap totally unacceptable. So there's obviously plenty of room for confusion here, and it'll be interesting to see just how close the two twin allies are going to be in the near future.
Well, that was sort of my follow-up question. How far apart are they on this issue around the UN? Why is it that the U.S. is opposed to the UN having a significant role in post-Saddam Iraq? We heard or saw reports last week where Colin Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, said that the U.S. had invested far too much into Iraq to allow the UN to come in and have a significant decision-making role. What's your read on that?
Basically, Blair believes himself, and he knows the rest of the world believes, that the United Nations is the only body that can sort of legitimize a new government and legitimize what was done. Bush doesn't believe this and just went along with it to keep Colin Powell and Blair happy. So, you know, we have a fundamental difference here. Although they were both digging for the same bone in the same hole, they were digging in different directions. And now it really is a test of Blair's domestic credibility. If he can pull it off, then he goes back to Europe and to Britain, sort of comes up smelling of roses. Whereas if he goes back empty-handed and the sort of unilateralists in Washington have won the day, then we're all in serious trouble, really, because these are the same people who seem to be, you know, you get these dangerous hints that they want to use Iraq as a base to attack Iran and Syria next. And I don't think the rest of the world quite agrees with that. There are no UN resolutions, not even the thinnest veneer of a UN cover or an international legal cover for attacking them. But you've heard the belligerent statements from Rumsfeld and others about them. So you've just got to fear the worst.
So where does General Tommy Franks fit into all of this? I thought he was the one that was slated to be the interim leader of Iraq.
He's in charge of security. They've carefully renamed General Garner is in charge of reconstruction. The next issue, apart from the military, is who's going to pay for all of this. And that's where America is in, to some extent, a sort of seriously weak position, because until the sanctions are officially lifted by the Security Council, it's illegal for anyone to buy Iraqi oil except through the UN Oil for Food program. This means that the U.S. can't just take the money and pay for its administration. As the last resolution on the temporary resolution on the Oil for Food finance points out, that the belligerent powers are responsible for maintaining the population and maintaining facilities. And that means the U.S. has got to pay as far as everyone else is concerned. They can't dip the UN till. And incidentally, Congress is actually proving quite strong upon this. The original plan released by the White House gave lots of money to the president, in his discretion, which he could give to the Department of Defense, whose representative General Garner is. What the Congress, both houses, I think, at the moment are pushing for is for this money to go to the State Department, which administers USAID. And that's what most of the NGOs and the aid groups are calling for, because, first of all, you know, soldiers are not very good at redevelopment and reconstruction. They're sort of moderately good at knocking things down and killing people, but not on keeping them alive afterwards. And secondly, I think at the back of the minds is that if it goes to the Department of Defense, you get into this sort of revolving door contracts, precisely like General Garner, where he leaves as head of Star Wars to become head of a big contractor for the Star Wars system. And I think there's a serious worry that if it gets into their remit, we'll see even more sweetheart contracts for this part of the sort of military-industrial complex. I wish I could see some sort of optimistic signs, but as long as... unless we have a regime change in Washington, I can see nothing but sort of instability and chaos spreading across the world for the near future. I wish it were different, but every time I've sort of suddenly thought that there's an attack of sanity in Washington, my hopes are dashed.
Ian Williams, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. While proponents of this war focus on dividing up the profits, anti-war activists continue their drumbeat against the invasion. Over the weekend, thousands around the world took to the streets. In Washington, activists held a festival for peace. Here are voices of dissent.
Boxes of dynamite might go off. There's a bomb in a building killing moms and children. Forget staying calm. Innocence is begging for peace. Armageddon is far from dead. Apocalypse is a rocket ship away. And I pray that this does not happen to me, even though it happens overseas every day.
As millions across the globe continue to protest the invasion of Iraq, the Campus Anti-War Network, made up of more than 200 anti-war groups from schools across the USA, organized an 8-hour-long festival of peace and nonviolence on Saturday at the Washington Monument.
The Americans and the Iraqis and the Brits and the Australians were losing together in the battlefields, in the media. You probably know that depleted uranium is radioactive for 45 billion years. You know that it's an alpha emitter. You know that alpha radiation causes more harm than gamma, beta, or X-ray because it's a particle that bombards the tissues, crushing through human cells and causing the symptoms of Gulf War syndrome and a health catastrophe in Iraq and health effects around the United States where these weapons have been tested. On the way south, we drove past the Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, just north of Baltimore. And depleted uranium began to be tested there long ago, in the mid-1950s, but local citizens didn't find out about it until the mid-1990s. And when our Gulf War vets come home this time with what seems like asthma, when those lung tissues are bombarded by radiation as this heavy metal sits in the lungs, the feeling is that you can't get your breath, you can't breathe, you've got no energy left. Some vets come back with a numbness, a loss of feeling in the face after they explored the battlegrounds where the tanks were destroyed. So let's just remind ourselves a little bit about the technicalities of this weapon. Not only is it pyrophoric, burning through tanks like a knife through butter, but the particles that are formed following an explosion, about 40% of it becoming tiny, minute particles, about 0.1 micron in size. And these small particles go right through the gas mask filters.
Young musicians, poets, speakers, and actors shared their message for a peaceful world. They also held workshops in a candlelight vigil, followed by an open mic.
As bomb drops on the people of Iraq, the ceiling tiles are falling in my classroom right across the river. And as our government secures $75 billion for this war just through the next 6 months, teachers without a raise, students without a school nurse or a music program, and basic classroom supplies now are being denied to us here in D.C. And this is not just D.C. This is what's happening across the country.
This is Selena Masuta reporting from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.